Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Real quick before we start the show, just wanted to let you guys know you can get the show 2 days early by joining our Patreon. Even for a buck, you can listen to the show 2 days early. Go to patreon.com/analogtalk and we got a bunch of stuff over there. Check it out and enjoy the episode.
Hey, you guys, welcome back to another episode of Analog Talk, a film photography podcast. I'm your host, Tim.
I'm Chris.
And on today's show, we have Ryan Pfluger. Hey, Ryan.
Hi, hello. Ryan. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm a huge fan of your what you have going on.
Same here.
So, before we get into all that, do you mind introducing yourself to our listeners and giving us a background how you got into photography?
Sure. My name is Ryan Pfluger. I was born and raised in Flushing, Queens.
Cool.
Moved to the suburbs when I was like 8 or 9, and then my photo journey kind of started in a more unchosen path. I was originally going to school for art history. After about 2 years, I realized I was tired of writing about dead white men. I took a photo course because it was part of my just like, you know, foundations doing a MFA, a BFA, actually. And then I really enjoyed it, and I was never really good making stuff with my hands, and it felt like photography was like this nice in between. And I realized also the school that I was going to wasn't the most providing in education for actually doing photography as a profession.
Right.
And kind of sped through the program and immediately applied to grad schools. And I got my MFA at the School of Visual Arts. And I was the youngest person that they had, at least at that point, admitted into the program. So I was 23 when I graduated. So I was 21 when I went into the program. And then from there, I realized that I couldn't just make a living as a poor person, as an artist. I came from a pretty, you know, lower middle class family. You know, I put myself through college and put myself through grad school. And my mentor at the time while I was doing my master's was Kathy Ryan at the New York Times Magazine. And she kind of really ignited a passion in me to start doing commissioned work, because also it ignited my bank account. And the rest is kind of history. So I've been working, you know, as a, I say working photographer for about, you know, 15 years or so now. And also my own personal practice as well.
I mean, that's, I have like so much to, just because your work is, it's kind of like aligned with like, I mean, it's just, it's like, I'm lost for words for it, but have you always been shooting film or did you kind of go through like the digital?
No, I'm old enough that I was always shooting film. I was taught in the dark room, you know, black and white and color, and I didn't even have a digital camera for myself until way after grad school. For the most part, still to this day, I'd say, you know, 90% of my work is on film.
That is incredible. Listeners have already heard my version of that story where in school, what's what we learned on, because that's all there was basically. And then getting into the digital because everybody was like, it's the new thing. You have to, if you're going to work, you got to get the digital.
It's the future.
Yeah, it's the future. So I like really admire that you were able to stick with it. Do you think it's mostly because it lends itself to your style more? Or do you think it was just what you were comfortable with and that's what you kind of wanted to stay with?
I think it's a little of both. I think for me, it's very much part of my practice. I shoot, these days just shoot mostly medium format. I started on 4x5, switched to something that was more accessible for me and more, you know, cost efficient while I was in grad school. And for, you know, I'm a really slow and silent photographer. So film has always been part of that process for me. I shoot completely differently when I shoot digitally. I think of it just as a different medium. You know, I'm not opposed to it. I just, it's not, aesthetically, it's not the same for me.
I almost feel like it's almost hard not to shoot differently with digital because you're just so, it's so easy to like run and gun around the set versus being intentional. Do you think the people you photograph appreciate that you go slower? Like, talk us through like a typical shoot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, the first thing that people actually say to me when they're actually starting to have a conversation is like, oh, you're shooting film. That's so, I haven't done that in so long.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that it also helps put people at ease a bit more of like knowing the competence of like what my skills are.
Right.
And it also, it just changes the dynamic, you know, with a bigger camera. It allows people to feel like they also need to be like more still, and my work is very still. So it like it totally informs the way you communicate with the subject. You know, I personally don't use like multiple backs because I like that kind of breathing room of me changing film and people actually seeing what the process is, because it allows for there to be some breath between photographs instead of just like, you know,
Right.
Man, that's so something cool. I haven't thought of that because, man, when you are firing off like a digital, like there's no break. There's no reason. I mean, unless your battery dies, but how often do we change batteries in a digital? You know what I mean? Like that's wild. I didn't even think of that. And to bring them with that, where you're like, all right, we got to change the role. And they're just like, what are you shooting now? Or something. You know what I mean? Like, it's, that's pretty cool. That's a pretty cool way
and
to.
And then, like, my favorite thing is also people being like, how is it looking? And I'm like, well, I know it looks good, but I can't. I can't tell you or show you because it's on film. But, you know, it's still, you know, because of where we are in present society, people like it, like that process doesn't even like necessarily infiltrate properly where they're like, oh, you're shooting film, but how is it looking? And it's like, well, I'll know in a day. I can't tell you right now.
Do you find, this is something I ask a lot of guests we have on the show who do your kind of work because they're, you know, a lot of digital is what is sort of like what clients prefer because they can get that immediate. You know, I did a shoot where we were pausing so the art directors could like go through and like say like, okay, these are great, let's move on. Do you get pushback in that? Or do people know this is what you do so they don't? Do you ever have to like plead your case for film, essentially?
When it comes to commercial work, yes. When it comes to editorial, no. No one ever forces me to shoot digitally.
That's great.
But with commercial work, I'd say that's the only thing that I do shoot digitally. And even then, I'll try to do some pushback of like, I'll shoot digital on a monitor for you to see it, but I'm going to shoot film for like what the final product is going to be. So it just puts them at ease and it allows me, because I'm like, you're having these, you know, references for me that aesthetically I'm not going to match digitally. They'll look similar, but it's like, if you want this specific thing, it needs to be this specific thing.
Man, that's where Polaroids would be coming in handy these days. I wish they still made the peel apart film. I mean, come on.
Yeah, that's what they did back in the day, huh?
I know.
You can see it. Here you go.
I just say that my digital camera is my Polaroid now. I'm just like, you want to see it? Here, I'll take some digital shots. You can see kind of what it's looking like and, you know, take it at face value and let me photograph how I want to.
Yeah, I feel like that's a good tip too for people that want to, you know, shoot more film on projects like that. If you do, because like I always like to test my lighting if I'm doing something like that, just making sure the exposure is good, you know, and I mean, I'm by far. That's the furthest thing I ever do, or jobs like that. But when I would, you know, it would always work out just to do like a strobe test and to make sure that everything looked okay. And
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I came from shooting Polaroids all the time.
Yeah.
For jobs and stuff and for my own work. And so it's just good for me for reference of just like, okay, this is what this looks like. Let me, you know, move stuff around before I get into my groove.
Mm. I'm very excited for your book. Congratulations on that, by the way.
Thank you.
Can you tell our listeners what that is and when it's coming and how you, like, what brought it, you know, out of you and all that stuff? We'd love to hear it.
Yeah, it's, you know, I've wanted to do a monograph for a really long time, and I didn't want it to be just a, like, anthology of my work. And I had been thinking about this body of work for about a decade, and just, you know, with my own work schedule and actual free time, I just didn't have it to be able to actually put the energy into making the work. And COVID hit, and I was like, okay, now's the time, because I knew that I wasn't going to be working. And it took me about like 3 or 4 months to really kind of figure out how I was going to go about doing it. And the book is called Holding Space, and it is it took me about 16 months, and it's 100 interracial queer couples throughout the U.S.
Oh, damn. Yeah.
So the body of work started with people that were really close to me, that were in my kind of immediate circle, because I wanted to just see how it worked, because I knew that the majority of the work was going to be with strangers. And also wanted to get insight from the couples themselves of how they felt about, you know, a queer person that is, you know, very white, doing a project that's about intersectionality. And that's, you know, it was something that I felt was missing from photography. And I didn't know if this was the right thing for it to help to facilitate it. And then after working with about 3 or 4 couples, I realized that this was the right path for me. And yeah, so then I wanted it to be a body of work where it was people that solely reached out to me.
I was just going to ask. Yeah.
So all of the couples, with the exception of about 10, are people that reached out to me that I never met before.
Wow.
Very cool.
I was gonna say, and I also knew that knew that it was like a book project. And also that I knew that it wasn't going to just be photography, and figuring out what, you know, that how that was going to live as a final body of work took a while. But it ended. I wanted to make sure that all of the couples had kind of control of their narrative, because I feel like that's often missing from photography, especially photojournalism, and, you know, photographers that work in more anthropological ways, that it often becomes a photographer statement and not a subject statement. And so I wanted to really make sure that I was removing myself as much as possible as, you know, as the voice of these people. I just wanted to be kind of like a facilitator more than anything. So all of the text in the book is all first person accounts. And it's not like interview style or anything. I just gave them prompts and things that I learned from spending time with them as like kind of starting points, but allowed them to talk about whatever it was that they felt was appropriate for like a public audience.
I can't wait. That sounds so like, my heart, I don't know if it's ready for that yet.
Because I'm in the starts of doing press for it, which is an interesting journey, because this is like a hybrid book, and the whole kind of point of it was that it was financially accessible as a monograph. So it's only $30, but it's by a large publisher, so it's mass marketed. You can get it anywhere, which is often not the case with photo books. And the fact that there is so much text, people think when you say like, oh, the photographer's putting out a book, that like, it's just going to be photographs. It has as many words as a novel. So It's okay. A book. It's a book that you need
yeah,
to read.
Yeah.
You know, most of the people that did blurbs for it that or got pre-pressed copies of it, you know, it took them like 4 or 5 hours to read it.
But I love that. It's like a, you know, an experience, you know, it's not just like, oh, you flip through like, oh, look how beautiful everybody is. Wow. But to like hear every, I'm assuming everybody's personal story is going to be just, you know, even
and it's
better.
It's a juxtaposition because also the couples, I like to say collaborators instead of subjects. They all got like, I didn't do releases for the reason that anyone that broke up after the fact that they didn't have to be involved with the book that I did, that they all had the final say and what images were used. So the end product is like me very removed from it.
Right.
You know, it's not necessarily the images that I would have chosen.
I love that.
And the text often is a very interesting juxtaposition where especially there's a lot of couples in the book that broke up during the process of me making it that decided to stay within the body of work. So you have these really, you know, emotionally hard stories to read of why people broke up and why, you know, what affects queer people within, you know, public and private places and how that differs with a relationship and how it affects it over time. And so, you know, you're seeing these photographs of like really loving, intimate moments and then text that's like, we were together for 5 years and I realized I couldn't be with a white person. And so it's like really, it's those nuanced conversations that's often missing from photography. And I wanted, and also just like the general, broader conversation that the world has. And I wanted to make sure that that was present because I think it's very important for like the queer experience. And especially when it comes to relationships and how we have to kind of build our own foundations of what relationships look like. And then when you come from different marginalized backgrounds, how different that can look for the individuals. And when you're trying to come together as a loving couple, that there's a lot of stuff under the surface that you can't see in image making. And I wanted to make sure that that was part of the story that I was telling.
Dude, man. Wow. That sounds so good.
Yeah.
So good.
You know, I have to say it's pretty fucking great.
I believe it. Especially coming from this world of photography where, you know, like you said, like a book comes out, there's nothing about the people really. You might get their age or what state it was shot in or something like that. Maybe a little blip in the back about it, but just to be focused kind of on the story as well is so, I love it.
I think that the kind of like jumping point of how I wanted it to be very different was thinking of photography books that have become part of kind of like the broad diaspora of photography of like something like Humans of New York, where it felt very controlling from the photographer's point of view of making sure to get stories that would elicit an emotional response that were a little bit utilizing people for your own means. And I really didn't want to do that. I wanted to make sure that the control was still in the people that I was photographing's hands. And I also didn't want it to be trauma porn. And I wanted it to be something that was really authentic and honest. And sometimes that's really joyful and sometimes that's not. And that's like the beauty of love in general is that it's not great all the time. And understanding how you work through that and then creating imagery that elicits that is an interesting process, especially with strangers being like, please, you know, show that you love each other and are in the privacy of whether it's your own home or, you know, because it was in COVID, a lot of it was outdoors for about the first year that I was doing it. So it was like, come to this secluded national park or state park and meet me here. And, you know, coming from a stranger, that's always a little interesting. You know, meet me in the woods and I'm going to take some photographs.
Dun, dun, dun.
So I think that it also says a lot about like how my process works in order to make people comfortable, because it's not like I'm like walking down the street asking people if I can make photographs of them. It's a very planned thing, but I'm also asking a lot of the people that I'm photographing, and I'm asking them to give a lot to me in their openness.
Yeah.
So it's creating a space that allows that to happen. So there's a lot of talking that happens and not necessarily a ton of photographing that happens.
Yeah. Do you plan on doing like a show for this?
That's the eventual hope is to, you know, I think because I walk that line between working photographer and artist, and I always have kind of like photographers of the past. And I think that, you know, as contemporary art world became more of a capitalist structure that, you know, you have to differentiate yourself. Like, I'm an artist. I don't do things for other people. And it's like, I enjoy the process of collaborating with people that hire me and doing things that are outside of what my normal comfort zone is. But when it comes down to it, it's like, I'm an artist. So it's a hard thing to kind of grapple with sometimes when people associate you as someone that does commissions, but also has a very substantial amount of personal work, because not all working photographers make work for themselves. And so,
you're right.
You know, the path that I chose makes it a little bit more complicated sometimes.
Man, so with this project, is, you know, the book and the, if you do a show and all that stuff, is that kind of the end for this? Or do you see this kind of being like a, like you might have a part two in you or, you know, it might be kind of like a series that you do down the road or something like that?
I already am kind of like workshopping for myself kind of more than to me, this book is like chapter one.
Okay.
Of a very kind of new way of working for myself. You know, it won't be the exact same subject matter, but it will be in the vein of intersectionality and queerness and kind of how that I'm very interested in just like Americana in general.
Yeah.
And I feel like that kind of documentation within queer culture is very much relegated to our own community and not to kind of a broader audience. And that's the point of this book, was to make it accessible to a broader audience, for these kind of stories to be read and seen by people that are in middle America that don't normally have access to this kind of stuff outside the internet, and to be able to just walk into your local bookstore and see something that is really full of what a queer life is. Like, that to me is something that I feel I'm very grateful for my publisher and for allowing it, that it can be something that is as accessible as it is.
What was the experience like of shopping it around? Did you know, was that a hard thing? Was it?
It was surprisingly the opposite. I think because of when I was making this. Because it was the beginning of COVID, and I was like pretty vocal on the internet just about the issues with the photography industry, and kind of I was giving some pretty heavy critiques on like why, you know, so many freelancers were having a hard time during COVID, and that there wasn't any safety blankets, and kind of what that's like for, you know, people like me that are quote unquote considered successful, and financially, like, it was a really difficult time for me.
Right.
And so I think it kind of brought more attention to the work that I was making during COVID. So I had multiple publishers approach me at the time.
That's great.
And I just really loved my editor. She really got my work and like the history of my work and how I kind of got to this place. And was able to kind of meet all of the things that I, you know, I still wanted it to be a glossy photo book. I still wanted it, but I wanted it to be for people that are of lower social economic backgrounds that could afford it, but that the quality was going to be the same. And, you know, they lined all of that up for me, and it ended up, you know, now seeing the final book, I'm really happy that it's like, it's a size that people can put in their bag, that it's not relegated to being a coffee table book. So it's all of those things that were like very much at the forefront of my mind. And Princeton Architectural Press, you know, during COVID, they also were going through some changes. My editor just started working there. And she had previously been at the bigger art book publishers and was brought on to kind of change things up a little bit at the publisher. And I was one of the first kind of books that she signed on to.
Yeah, I love that. I love that you can just, you can pre-order it like at I'm Barnes and Noble's where I'm getting it. Like I was like, oh, this is so great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, like I said, congratulations, Ryan. This is,
thank you.
It's, yeah,
yeah, it's huge.
I get goosebumps just thinking about it. So,
and the fact that you know, like you said, like you're keeping it affordable, because it's so easy to mark these things up and make it so insane, because there's so many books I'd buy all the time and I'm just like, damn, $85, like come on, like it's killing me. But just the fact that this is such an important story to tell, along with, like, you know, it being accessible to, I mean, $30, everybody's, that's like three trips to Starbucks, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's
and that's always the problem that I've had with photo books, is that the edition sizes are usually very small because they have to be. And then the more mass marketed ones are, from being upfront, like very famous, very financially successful photographers. And then you have books that are selling for, you know, like Annie Leibovitz's new book is selling for $100. Stephen Klein's new book is selling for $250, where it's like an art student can't buy that. Someone that lives, you know, in Ohio in a small town can't buy that. But they may love photography and they may love art. And it's like the idea that, you know, I'm not making any money off of this. It's like, I'd have to sell, you know, sell 100,000 books to even recoup the cost that it costs me to make this. So, but that was important to me, is like, I think that's what's important with just like community building as a, as an artist. I feel like that's my job. And I take that really seriously. So I wanted to make sure that, like, for my first monograph, that that was very apparent.
Well, we thank you. We thank you for that. Kind of going back to you know, your professional work and being the artist, do you think that's why I never get into professional work, is because I just feel like the burnout of making it like my job would kind of take away from the art? Do you ever have that conflict and battle inside of you of where it's like, you know, oh, I'm doing this for my job, and then when you're finally ready to go out and shoot stuff, are you just like, damn, I have to go shoot again? Or how do you balance that?
Yeah, I mean, every month I feel that way. I think, you know, for a long time, you know, because I was really poor, I like couldn't figure out if I was going to be able to pay my rent each month. You know, I was I didn't move to California until about 4.5 years ago. But you know, living in New York, it was like I was moving to smaller and smaller apartments. They were costing more and more money, and so I ended up concentrating all my time on commissions, because it was the way that I was able to have money that was, that I could rely on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I wanted to make sure that I made a name for myself, that that would always kind of exist for me, especially as a backup. So it may have taken like a decade for me to be like financially comfortable. And then it just happened that a pandemic happened when I was just in the place of like, oh, I'm starting to go back to really making work for myself. And, you know, for the few years prior to me moving out to California, I was getting that burnout really hard. And so I would take like 6 to 7 weeks off, and I would drive cross country and I would just make work. And that was like my way of resetting myself. But I knew that I just still didn't have the time to really invest in, this is a body of work, this is what this is, that my commission work still became priority. And I think that I just needed a big shift, like a pandemic, to make it that I really prioritized self and like what my voice was over jobs that weren't happening anyway. And so now I'm able to kind of bring that same mindset into my commissioned work, where it's like, things that I may have said yes to a few years ago, I don't anymore. I need to be really excited about either the project or the subject or the person that I'm working for. It needs to be really financially motivating. Like, I have a lot of, it's a lot of factors to get through to yes now, where it was like, okay, it's like one or two that I'm like, I'm into the person I'm photographing, but it's like not really any money. And like, where I now I just say no to stuff like that.
Isn't that crazy? How many times I've been like, oh, we want to hire you, but just so you know, there's no budget. It's like,
well, you're not hiring then. You're not hiring.
Yeah, it's like, is that supposed to, like, is that, like, what is that? Like, okay, what?
I think also because, you know, of social media and the internet, there's become this mindset that there's always someone that's going to be able to do it for cheaper mm-hmm. and faster.
Yep, right.
And because we have so much more access to like options instead mm-hmm. of like really having to navigate creating relationships with people that would be commissioning you, which is like the old timey way of going about things.
Yeah,
where it's like, you know, I can get an email from someone now that I've never spoken to ever being wanting to commission me. And, you know, 15 years ago, that would never happen, you know? So it was just, it's me understanding that me saying no to something doesn't mean that I'm losing out on anything. It's me stepping away from something, realizing this is not what's best for me right now.
Ryan, that is, I'm kind of in that same place in what I do too. I just became a mom 7 months ago.
Oh, congrats.
Thank you. So that changes. I'm not going to spend my time 12 hours on set for no money. Like you have to make it worth my while now if I'm going to, you know, get a babysitter or just even be away from him for that long. So and I think it takes a while to get there. You know, when we're young and hungry, we're like, well, I'll take it. I'll do it. You know, and some of these jobs I was doing, they were rough. They were long days, you know, in the cold. I was doing on-set photography. And to get $200 was like insane, you know? So yeah, I definitely hear you and feel that when you talk about prioritizing just your life.
Yeah, especially as a female photographer, I think that, you know, I'm almost 40 and most of, you know, my photography friends are kind of in that age range that are having kids where they're like not comfortable, you know, having their pregnancy known on social media because they don't want to not be hired, you know, and it's like, it's all of those things of like where I have, you know, a few friends that have, you know, one or two younger kids, like toddlers, where they're like, I'm burnt out in the way where that stuff just doesn't interest me anymore because I have to prioritize what makes me feel good, what is good for my family, what is where I can't put myself in situations anymore that I would have maybe 5 years ago because it's not worth it. And it doesn't, it doesn't help anyone's career.
When you were saying a lot of your friends, it kind of makes me feel a little bit, not better, but that insecurity that I had of not putting my pregnancy out because I knew maybe I wouldn't get hired. It's kind of insane to even say it out loud. You know what I mean?
But it's just factually true.
Yeah.
It's just factually. I think that, you know, something that I've always kind of prided myself on because I couldn't hide the fact that I was queer. You know, I've always made work that referenced that in some way.
Right.
And, you know, that can lead to people not hiring you. And it does lead to people not hiring you. I think that any marginalized person knows that. Mm-hmm. And that is not exclusive to whether it's like your race or your sexuality or your identity. It also is whether you're just a man or a woman.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of stuff that is unsaid within our industry that people don't like to talk about because there's this fear of backlash or not being hired or the word of mouth of like, oh, this person is just someone that complains all the time. It's like, my thing is always, I only say things that are factual to the industry.
Right.
Because it's my lived in experience.
Right.
So if anyone has issue with that, they probably need to reevaluate themselves
100%.
Because it's something that they're not thinking about. And when I say, oh no, like being queer has been a huge hindrance to my professional career, while the best thing that about my work and how I create, it's like those two things are not mutually exclusive and they live together, and it's figuring out how to navigate that. And by being a vocal person, I at least can, you know, go to sleep at night knowing that I am authentically being me in a way that is not aggressive towards other people, but is at least letting people know this is what I face as a photographer, that you don't have to.
Right.
And I think that those conversations are really important. And because there isn't like some watering hole where all photographers can just meet and be like, okay, let's like lay the shit out here.
Right.
It makes it where you do have those feelings of like, oh, I don't now I don't feel alone knowing that like someone that maybe I deem as more successful than me is feeling the exact same things or has experienced the same exact things. And, you know, again, it goes back to that community building, because I think that like the idea of community and the photo community is actually a fallacy, that there's such a fear of competition and someone taking something away from you or someone using your ideas, that we're all so secluded in these like very isolating worlds that, you know, we're not able to be like, oh, like that producer that I worked with was like really aggressive towards me. And like, I think that that should be known to other people. And like, where it's like, this isn't just a personality conflict. Like the professionalism of this person is not okay.
Right.
Or I felt like I was being stereotyped and I felt like I was being relegated to just being a queer person instead of you're a great photographer that also happens to be queer.
Right.
It's like those are two very different things. And I think just talking about them is like the first step. But, you know, it's a hard thing when everything is so separate and everyone, you know, works in their own little worlds to make it like, okay, what are the changes that we can make as a whole?
Right.
So I think that, you know, at least right now, the solution is like, oh, okay, like you're not alone being, you know, a new mom.
Right.
Not wanting to take jobs because it's just not going to make you feel good and it's not worth it. And what's more worth it is spending time at home with your family.
Right.
And that does not take anything away from your work.
Yeah. Thanks, Ryan. I'm getting a little teary.
So like looking back, get to go back like 10 years ago, like how different are things now than it used to be? I mean, I feel like even from my point of view of looking at the world, it's funny. I was watching a documentary on Woodstock 94 and the band Blind Melon was playing and he had a dress on and it was like people were fucking appalled over this dress. And I'm like, holy shit, that's right. This world is, it used to be so, you didn't hear anything about stuff that wasn't just the heterosexual, you know, this and that and that. I mean, how do you feel now, like it being 2022?
It's a difficult question to answer because I think that people are more aware, but I don't think people have really made big changes in their own lives or how they treat people or how they even associate things with certain, you know, I think the perfect example is George Floyd and Black Lives Matter. And if you look at magazines pretty much from June of 2020, till about the summer of 2021, it was mostly Black photographers that had been so hungry and fighting to get even meetings or answers from people that all of a sudden were photographing covers of magazines for people that ignored them for 5 years.
Right.
And with also Black subjects on the covers. And the problem with all of that is that editors kind of treated that moment in time as how they've always treated things, where it's like, we're going to use the same 5 to 8 people because there's only 5 or 10 really exceptional photographers that can actually do this stuff, which is not true. at all.
Yeah.
And we're going to do the same thing that we have done with cis straight white dudes for the history of our publication. And you look now and you can start seeing things shifting back to business as fucking usual.
Yeah, that's what I was worried about.
You know, the same thing happened, you know, when all of a sudden it was like there was all of these violent, well, I say publicly known violent acts against Asian people.
Right.
All of a sudden, we were having Asian awareness within photography. Yeah. We were having more stories about it. Fast forward a year later, where are those stories?
Right.
And so I take everything that kind of happens with a grain of salt, where, you know, even just in just like the public realm of culture of like, you know, it's like Billy Eichner's kind of press run for his movie Bros. And it's like this big thing of like the first rom-com, it's all gay, lesbian, queer people and all the roles and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, people are like, kind of like, oh, like, I'm kind of tired of hearing about it, yada, yada. And it's like, I get the momentum behind it because it hasn't existed before.
Right.
So it's like, but does that, in order, if it's successful, does that still mean that we're going to have to do this all over again for you to want to make these movies?
Right.
And I think that infiltrates everything within the culture, where it's like, if it's not consistent for decades upon decades, you can't even have the conversation of like, how are things now compared to 10 years ago? Because honestly, nothing has changed significantly for a continued period of time to actually appropriately answer that question. Mm. I can still go places in America and get out of my car when I'm driving cross country and go to myself, am I safe here?
Mm. Yeah.
And that just having to have that conversation with yourself as someone like me who likes going into places that I haven't been before and having to know for myself, am I going to just be safe to be in this place? When I don't have to think about that anymore, right, is when I can have a conversation of whether things have changed.
This world. Shit.
Yeah.
You know, I just did a workshop at the Anderson Ranch, which is a fucking amazing place in Colorado. Ooh. And my class was originally called Intimacy in Photography. And after the first day I went to my class, I was like, actually, this really should be called Ethics and Philosophy in Photography. Mm. I happened, because it was people that were signing up for a class with me. It happened to be a really diverse range of people. And most of the conversation was about, depending on what your identity is, what kind of access you have to places, what kind of access you have to communities.
Yeah.
And it usually comes down to, a straight white man can go wherever the hell he wants, photograph whoever he wants, become successful off of it.
Yep.
And no one bats an eye, right, except for the marginalized people that are like, what the fuck? Why are you coming into my community and doing this? And it's right, like, what we would do field trips, and like we went to a rodeo, and I was like, you know, for the black and brown people that were in my class, and also in the majority of my class was also queer. And it was like, I want you to understand what it feels like to be in the space that you wouldn't normally go to, and really reckon with those feelings to understand, like, a lot of times it has nothing to do with the photographer's work. It has to do with the access to the things that they want to make work of, and it not being accessible, or it not being a safe space, which is why we see bodies of work from photographers that are not from those communities, because they don't have, it's a very complicated place to have those conversations, but at the same time, it's really easy. It's like, it could be so much easier than what it is.
Right.
And I think just kind of highlighting those differences of just the simplest thing as access, it changes the way that we actually historically look at photography. And I think that that's really important, especially people that are, you know, analog photographers, that are film photographers, that really spend time with their practice in that way, whether it's in the darkroom or, you know, that having the access to places is so important.
100%.
I agree. And it's always good to hear. Thank you for everything you were saying. It just feels so good to hear, because being a straight white male, like you said, I mean, all that stuff, like just when the Black Lives Matter movement was at its height and just how participating everyone was in, like, you know, building up that community and doing all this stuff. And then, you know, everything kind of simmers down after a while, like the dust kind of settles in those times. And it's so easy to just go back to your normal, you know, like you said, I never have that fear of, am I going to be safe here walking down this alleyway, you know? And I'm totally fine.
Yeah.
And I, even for me, in places that I am normally comfortable, because I do a lot of public photographing in places where it's like, there's people walking by, and it's like, a lot of times, like, I am in the back of my head of like, are people looking at the way that I'm dressed or the way that I present myself? Yeah. It's like, I am non-binary. It's like, sometimes I'm more mask than others. Mm-hmm. And it's like, the idea of not only am I safe, but is the person that I'm photographing feeling safe and comfortable? It's like the fact that I have to have those that thought process while I'm making work sucks. And I think that, you know, it's not to say also like I don't want to see work by like straight white dudes. Like it's
totally get that.
I think that, you know, am I exhausted and tired of it at times? Yes. But it also doesn't, I always equate it as like me having more of a voice right now does not take anything away from your voice ever. It's just a matter of taking more time to listen than to speak. And a lot of people are not comfortable with doing that because it's like, if you let what I'm saying sit with you for a while, it's like, then come back to me and then we can have like the real, real conversation of like what those feelings are and also how that informs the work that you make in the future. Because it's like, even just, I know my words are going to inform people from my own community, but they're also going to inform people outside of it of being like, oh, maybe I shouldn't go into this place and make work here because this is not the place for my voice right now. Maybe in 50 years it is, but right now let me give space to allow people to tell their own stories, because there's exceptional photographers of every background and most of them don't get a single minute of time.
I remember when I forget who I was watching or who was, it was like a video or a documentary or something about it was an ex-drug addict, and he was documenting his old kind of stomping grounds. And he was explaining how, you know, these people go into these areas for the, you know, the gimmick, the cheap shot of getting these people, the homeless people or the drug addicts looking in their worst, because of course it's going to get shock and awe and views and clicks. But it's like, if you don't belong there, that's, you don't belong there to tell that story. That's not your, it, I just feel like it's, I remember when I was getting into documentary style photography and trying to tell a story through my work. And I took a couple shots of people sleeping on park benches with a liquor bottle next to them. And I was like, oh, I can't wait to share this. People are going to love this. And then looking at it later being like, wow, I'm such a dickhead. Like, that's just not cool. Like, I don't know.
I think it, again, it comes down to like, a lot of conversation has not been had necessarily about intent, you know, especially because, you know, photography is the one medium where it's like, it's real life. Real life a lot of the times. And we forget that, you know, how someone's image is made and then seen, how that's going. It's like, just like all the true crime kind of like real life, you know, series that have been very much of the culture recently, where it's like, we're not thinking about how that affects those actual real people that are still alive, seeing themselves depicted by someone else that probably never even met them, had a conversation with them, and like what that does to someone's psyche. And it's like the same thing happens within photography, where it's like, I think a lot of like historically, where it's like you have someone like Nan Golden, who is really invested within, it was her friends, it was the people that she was existing with, it was her world, where it's like it wasn't utilizing people in any way. It was like, this is just what my experience is. And I think that those conversations need to happen more, where it's like, okay, like you can make beautiful photographs, but it's like, what's your intent? Why are you photographing this community? And why is it that your voice is the one that's important to tell that story? Because I think that that's the question we really need to ask. It's like, am I the person that needs to be telling this? Or is there someone that's better suited, that also has better experience knowing this, that should be telling it instead? And, you know, to bring it back to my work, a lot of people have asked, like, with holding space, like, have you been in, are you in an interracial couple now? And my response is, I have been, I have lived an experience. What my present experience is none of your business, but I would never have been navigating these really difficult conversations if I didn't have them with myself and with my own partners and my own friends, where it's like, this is something that is very complicated and it's not a, you know, I'm advocating for interracial couples. It's actually the opposite. It's like I'm bringing light to what it means to love someone that does not have the same experience as you do in a very visceral way. It's not, it's much different than like, oh, we come from, you know, he had a little bit more wealth and like had a little bit more access to college. It's like, we're talking about night and day experiences, right, but loving each other and wanting to exist together, both in private and public, and what that means, because that's a very different conversation.
Mm, totally.
Dude, I can't wait for this book. I'm stoked. I know. Oh, it's going to be a good one.
One of the things I saw on your Instagram, we kind of touched on a little bit, the industry notes section that you had. It kind of really resonated
some
with
some of the
me.
Highlights.
Yeah, the highlights. Of, you know, you speak about, you know, not getting a fair shot, or like getting to, you basically kind of what we talked about already. But my point is, like, do you have any advice for somebody who's just starting out?
Don't. I'm kidding. You know, I would, my biggest advice is find peers immediately that can be your support system, because trying to do it on your own never will work. And also, you can never trust anyone that is commissioning you to commission you a year later or 2 years later. I think that's the, you know, the biggest lesson that I had to learn over time, was that, like, even though I facilitated kind of relationships that lasted for 5 or 6 years that I thought were really great, but then, like, as soon as I moved across the country, it was like crickets, and I didn't hear anything. And it's really understanding that there's an ebb and flow constantly, kind of no matter where you're at in your career, especially, you know, there. Actually, the further you get in your career, sometimes the more difficult it gets, because it becomes less and less people that you're necessarily competing with, but the opportunities are not as much, because it's like you're up for bigger and bigger jobs, and those aren't as prevalent as like, oh, this is a small, you know, one page editorial. We have, you know, $400 for the day, all inclusive, go figure it out. Right. And, you know, someone that's just starting out is like, yeah, I'm going to take that. Like, that's exciting. Yeah. And it's like me, I'm like, that doesn't even cover my costs. So
Right.
And so it's like, people won't approach me for those kind of jobs anymore. So it's like, for someone starting out, I think that you really need to create other peers that are in this, on the same playing field as you, to really form bonds with. And then also, mentors, people that have been maybe 2 or 3 years kind of ahead of them in their career, maybe not someone that's been doing it for 20, 25 years, because they don't have the same. It's like while the industry has stayed the same for the most part, the changes are, you know, it's just like me, where it's like I started out where it was like I had in-person meetings, I brought my portfolio to editors. I don't do that anymore. Right. And no one really does that anymore. And so it's like, a lot of the stuff that I did starting out, I can't give that advice to people anymore. Right. So it's like finding the people that have had a little bit of success, that are maybe a few years older than you, and that are willing, you know, I try to be as mentor-y as possible whenever someone reaches out. But also, if I know that I am not the right fit for someone, I very much am like, this is the advice I can give you, but I think that like what you're looking for, whether it's assisting or I don't think that you're going to get the experience that you want from me. And so I'm going to help you find someone else that will maybe give you that or make suggestions. But like, I'm letting you know, I'm not that person. And it's not to say that I don't want to help you out. It's just, everyone's different. And I think that it's like finding the people that have had similar experiences to you or will have similar experiences to you. Again, not treating all photographers as if they're the same thing. It's like some people are very happy photographing weddings. And it's like, I can't give you advice on that. But I can direct you to like people that maybe can, because I don't know what that is like. Right. So I think that's the best advice, is really, it's like, from day one, making sure that you have a support system, because in industry where it's like you don't have HR, you don't have 401k, it's like you don't have health insurance. It's like at least have people that you know that you can rely on.
Yeah, that's great advice.
We'll be right back with a listener question for Ryan right after this message from our sponsor. Just wanted to pop in quick and let you guys know about our Patreon-only Develop and Hang Nights. Now, we've done a bunch of these already. They're a ton of fun. We talk shop, we develop some film, we laugh. We also try to get former guests for these as well. So if that sounds like something you're interested in, head over to patreon.com/analogtalk. Patreon is the best way to support the show. Thanks, guys.
All right, everybody. So this is the part of the show where we take a break and take a question from one of our listeners. This week's question comes from former guest Sarah Stellino, and she asks, what are some techniques you use to promote intimacy between two people that you're photographing together? That is a great question.
It is a great question. And it's also, having said earlier, having just taught a week-long workshop on intimacy. and the fact that I started it off with saying you can't teach how to teach intimacy to other photographers. The biggest technique that I've always used is to have zero expectations. Mm. I think that going into something requiring something of someone, especially if it's someone that you haven't met, it automatically leads to an imbalanced power dynamic. And I think that photography is in general an imbalanced power dynamic. Mm-hmm. And it's figuring out how to regulate that for yourself into making it feel like a give and take. And I think that's always been the way that I walk into things is, these are ideas that I have. These are things that I was thinking about when we started talking about doing a session together. You don't have to do any of this. This is just where my brain is at. Let's see how we connect with each other before we start asking things of each other. I think that, we have photography is such a powerful form in the arts that where it's like you're capturing someone's image. And especially when you're wanting something that is quote unquote intimate, that's asking a lot of someone. And so I think coming into any space with the person that you're collaborating with them knowing that nothing that they do is wrong and that whatever they're open to is the right thing because it's the right thing for them. And so that should be the right thing for you. Mm. And I think that, as photographers, we're so capable of changing things on the fly. It's like, it's how we see the world. It's like, I go into one situation thinking it's going to be something. And then I get there and I'm like, the space is not what I thought it was. Yeah. Let me reconfigure to still make this feel like me. And I think that mindset goes into anything. So it's like, if you're making work that's about intimacy, you're like, oh, I was expecting, this person to be nude and doing this thing under here. And it's like, well, maybe it's just actually an implication of something and you're not actually showing it. And you're still describing in the feeling of intimacy. It's like they're so, and it also is solely based on how the photographer works. It's like whether you're a photographer that talks a lot, whether you're a photographer that's very much about directing things, or whether you just exist in a space with someone and you don't take many photographs like I do, it's solely dependent on what your own workflow is, but also always being conscious of the person you're photographing's comfortability and also checking in with them, being like, I know you said you were okay with this, but now after, photographing with me for a bit, I want to still make sure that you are okay. And I think just giving people those check-ins and those reference points of what my work looks like, the range that it can go to. And we don't need to go from point A to point B in 10 seconds. It's like, we can work to that. If that means me coming back, or us working together a few times until you feel like it's a safe space with me, because you're not someone that normally does something like this. And then also if you're like a photojournalist or a documentarian or someone that is kind of existing in spaces for a while, it's like you break that fourth wall and make sure that you are doing check-ins, that you're not just a fly on the wall, because it's like, you could be documenting moments that someone isn't comfortable with.
Oh,
and while
wow.
you may be
yeah.
depicting quote unquote intimacy, it's not the kind of intimacy that the person your photograph wants to be depicted in. Mm, and
right.
I think having those conversations actually leads to much more intimate photographs because someone feels safe with you.
Right.
And also doesn't feel used by you, where it's like, oh, you just stuck around for, you know, a couple of weeks because you wanted to really get these specific moments that really should, you know, the emotionally naked or physically naked side of me that maybe our personal relationship actually isn't in that place yet. And now I feel like I'm using this person just because I can walk away. And like, I think that's the biggest advice I can give is constantly giving check-ins with people that you're photographing and never expect anything from them. The only expectations should be of you creating a safe space for them.
Right. I love that.
Man.
Great answer.
Yeah.
Great question. Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks, Sarah.
I just feel like I learned a lifetime of of experience right there. Awesome.
Okay, so now we have the tough question that we always say. If you had to pick one camera for the rest of your life, you're stranded on a desert island, you can only use one forever, what would it be and why?
Would I have access to be able to, if I went on an island, I don't know if I could develop film.
Yeah.
So
we call it the magical desert island where there's a photo lab. There's you can get batteries if you need batteries.
Great. It's actually the easiest question for me. I have almost exclusively for 20 years now shot with a Mamiya RZ.
Beautiful.
That's
my
go-to tank of a camera. You know, I've tried picking up other cameras along the way. It's like I have a Mamiya 7. It's like I have other cameras that I use. But like, if I am only going to use one camera, it's that camera always.
Wow.
It's a legend too. A camera
It is.
It's a workhorse.
It is.
It's just a
totally.
Camera that, you know, it's also when going back to just the beginning of when people ask, like, how does it look? I know exactly what I'm going to get with that camera before I get my film back. It's like, I immediately can be like, okay, it's going to be the last frame on that roll because I know exactly what it looked like.
Yeah.
And it's one of those cameras that, like, what you see is what you get.
Yeah.
And, you know, with range finders, it's like, oh, did I crop this right? And, like, just, for me, there's something really visceral about that camera. And also that it, like, it literally can be, like, dropped on the ground 100 times.
I told the story, I think, last episode. I just acquired a RB, and I haven't been shooting it enough. But, like, seeing stuff that, the camera can, you know, create is just like, man, I gotta go to the gym and like work out my arm so I can carry that camera around.
I have never handheld it in my entire career. I am one of those.
Yeah.
I have really shaky hands. I'm also very blind. And so it's like, I need the stability of that. Cause I actually, the first film camera I ever had was, Mamiya 6.45.
Okay.
I kind of started out with medium format.
Yeah.
So that was kind of like the next choice as I was like building up a comfortability of medium format, and I just have used it ever since.
I love it.
Good answer.
Great camera.
Yeah.
Okay. Now we have a part two. I don't know if you may or may not have an answer for this, but is there any camera that you are currently like dreaming of? White whale camera, like something you're like, man, I would love.
I'm actually like meeting with a friend next week to help me pick out a 4x5. I'm very much into going back to my roots. It's been about 20 years since I've shot 4x5. Even just looking at the body of work I just made, I'm like, man, I wish I shot this all in 4x5.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't have been the same project and I wouldn't have been able to do it in the amount of time that I did.
Right.
But now just like looking to the future, it's like, I know how that makes my work look for me personally, that it's just, it's on the horizon.
Cool.
But like, I want like a I want a really nice one. So that's why I'm like, it's like a full investment, and so
totally.
I'm trying to figure out what that is.
Mm.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see what you create with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And those two complement so well. Like the RZ, I feel like almost has like a 4x5 look to it. Mm-hmm. It really is close
it's
to
the
that.
Only reason why I use it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Makes sense.
Oh, exciting.
It's a great fake out camera.
It is.
It's like a lot of, especially people that like don't have like the exact eye for it. They'll like, especially when they see prints, they're like, is this 4x5? And I'm like, is it?
Is it?
You tell me.
Maybe it is.
Man, it's so good.
Well, Ryan, we can't thank you enough. Like I said before, I think everything we talked about in this episode needed to be said and heard, and we thank you. We think our listeners are really going to enjoy this episode, so thank you for taking the time to chat with us today.
Of course, been a pleasure.
Where can everybody check you out? Also, when's the book coming? Where can they pre-order? Give it all to us.
Yeah, and my Instagram is just my name, Ryan Pfluger. My website hasn't been updated in about 4 years, but check that out if you want. And then, Holding Space releases on November 8th, and you can pre-order it anywhere that you can pre-order a book.
Amazing.
And I would highly suggest pre-ordering it from your local bookstore.
Yeah.
Good call.
Yeah. If you call your local bookstore and just ask them, they will pre-order it for you.
Amazing.
So that's it. Yeah.
Awesome. Ryan, thank you again. This has been phenomenal. And we will see everybody next time.
Yay.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, that's going to wrap up this week's episode. Chris and I would love to thank Ryan for coming on the show. Man, we are so excited about your book. Everything we talked about today, just like dear to our hearts. This was an episode that needed to happen. Ryan, thanks so much for taking the time to hang out with us. We really appreciate it. We love what you're doing, and we are super excited to see what the future holds for your career. Guys, that's going to take us to Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/analogtalk. For only $1, you can get the show 2 days early. We also have our Patreon-only develop and hang nights and a bunch of other stuff there in the archives. If that sounds like something you're interested in, again, head over to patreon.com/analogtalk. Patreon is the best way to support the show. All right, guys. So until next week, we will see you with an all-new episode. Keep shooting and all that fun stuff. And yeah, we'll see you soon. Later.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.